If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN with one of my favorite people on this planet, Dr. Teresa DePorter, who's positively brilliant. She's boarded not only in America in veterinary behavior, but also in Europe. And may I say, a dance partner of mine at one point in time, we spoke together, Dr. DePorter, what, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 times? I don't remember over the years.
Hi, Steve. I'm so glad to be here and just reflect on our time together. I've known you, I don't know, for such a long time. And every time we get together, we get to talk about good things about dogs and cats.
Have you noticed, though, that when you see certain people, even if you haven't seen that person in 5 years, it's never gone that long since I've seen you, I don't think, but you just kind of pick up where you leave off? Is that a sign of a good friend?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the rainy weather or the sunny weather friend, whatever it is, you're right back where you were.
Yeah, I think so, too. I want to talk. One thing we talked about when we were speaking together at various veterinary conferences, something called pheromones. And we spoke about how pheromones can help pets with some anxiety, whether it be thunderstorm anxiety, anxiety due to Uncle George coming to visit with his stinky cigars, anxiety due to maybe moving to a different household, a long, long list of possibilities, and how pheromones may be able to help. So I want to start here. What are we talking about? What are pheromones?
So pheromones are given off from the mother dog to the nursing puppies naturally. And then there are various products that are synthetic derivations of these collections of pheromones. And what they do for the dog is they create that cozy, homey, everything is fine, I'm back with my mother sort of feeling. And people have a hard time knowing what the pheromone does because it's kind of mystical and magical and floats in the air. And really, I think if people are in tune to watching their dog's body language, when the dogs are exposed to pheromones, they kind of soften and relax. It's a beautiful thing when you open up and watch out what happens.
And also cats, you know, and rabbits, and really so many species, including insects, on this planet. Now, very few of us keep pet insects and need to deal with pheromones for stressed out insects. However, cats and rabbits, for sure, same kind of thing that you're talking about, correct?
Absolutely. There are a couple different pheromones for cats. Some are the ones that help the cats think about location, and others are pheromones that help them think about bonds and relationships.
All right. So you've got these pheromone products, and a French veterinarian years ago, decades ago, came up with the idea that we can use analogs or copies of these pheromones to help deal with a wide variety of behavior problems at that point in time in cats and then quickly after that in dogs. But that was decades ago. So the good news is they're, as they say, new and improved. That's kind of exciting, I think.
I've been watching Dr. Peugeot from France and his journey with pheromones for a long time. And there's been a lot of research on this, a lot of different applications for it. And now he's got some exciting new products. But I'm just really looking forward to seeing how these are going to work in our homes.
And what they do is to provide or help to provide the pet to feel secure, the dog and the cat. Now, we like to feel safe and secure as human beings. We're hardwired to want to feel that way. I would argue dogs even more so, and cats 10 times more so, perhaps. What do you think?
Absolutely. We all want to be comfortable in our space. We all want to be in a situation where we feel familiar. And that's what pheromones do, is they help give some of that familiarity.
And in fact, the line of pheromones is called Secure. and they're available on Amazon and lots of places where pet products are sold. And one nice thing is that there's no alcohol base anymore. I don't know about you, but every now and again, didn't happen every day, but I would hear someone say, you know, I smell the alcohol in this. And if that is true, and the alcohol base was, and you could describe it better than I can, I'm sure, was needed to activate the actual pheromone. Today, that's not needed. He's figured out how to do that. Because if we could smell, because dogs and cats, their sense of smell is so much better than ours. So if we could pick up on that, certainly the pets could too. And then the other problem with the plug-in products is the way in which people sometimes use them. You know, you'd put a plug-in product in the outlet and open the window right above it. So whatever came out of the plug-in product then would go literally right out the window. So Dr. Paget has said, okay, we can do better and eliminate some of the hiccups that occurred sometimes with some of the products.
Yeah, I think it's exciting to see the two things that you've talked about. One, the diffusers. A lot of people don't like to have something plugged in. Or wherever you want and wherever you need it to be plugged in for the cat, there's not an outlet there. There's something else in the outlet. So coming up with a product that doesn't rely on being plugged into a certain spot on the wall is super exciting.
And it's like I didn't mean to interrupt. It's like those, I don't know, you can probably tell me, when women buy, or men, those things that, what do you call them that help the room smell nice and they've got sticks in them? This is kind of like that and it looks very nice as well.
Right. The little diffuser sticks. I don't know what they're called either.
Diffuser sticks will work. And it's pure pheromone, which is probably more cost effective on top of everything else.
That would seem reasonable. Now, and I've used the spray, the pheromone sprays in the past, and they do have a funny odor. And, you know, what the direction I've had to give to people is spray this, let it sit for a while before you put it down for your pet, because we don't want to have the animal be exposed to that. And that's often a barrier because people don't want to wait or they forget or they, like, I don't have 15 minutes to do this. So something that we don't have to have a delay before we introduce it to the pet is going to be a really exciting advantage to this new product line.
Mm-hmm. So again, it's called Secure and available on Amazon. And we talk about studies. Well, you did some of those initial studies about pheromones. And are they helpful? And if so, in just like a minute or so, Dr. DePorter, for what kinds of things in general?
I like to use pheromones in most of my application for dog and cat behavior problems. So whether it's aggression or house soiling or fears and anxieties of thunderstorms or going to the veterinary clinic, almost anything that's going to cause a pet fear and anxiety, the pheromones can have a role, maybe a supporting role, but a role in that pet's behavior program.
Speaking of fear and anxiety, the dog training world recently has been turned upside down. Now, friends, I am talking to the person who really conducted one of the definitive studies ever on dog training methods and why some methods work way more better. Is that what is that? Way more better.
Way better.
Thank you. Yes. Or way more better, either way. Then others, and we'll talk about that when we come back with Dr. Teresa DePorter on WGN. Talking with veterinary behaviorist Dr. Teresa DePorter on WGN Radio, now about dog training methods. So here's what happens. If you're a dog trainer, you don't need, anyone can say, Dr. DePorter, I think, I'm a dog trainer, and put a sign in their window saying, I'm a dog trainer, without being certified officially by anyone. And the Certification Council for Professional Dog Trainers set out to change all that. So people would need to be, by law, certified to say, as many other professions, you know, that I really am a dog trainer. I can prove it. I've been certified. And by this organization or this organization, I think, in theory, that is a good thing. And in describing what that certification standard is, they said it would be okay to use any equipment and specifically said, including the prong collars, which look like those cartoon dog collars with those pointy things going in, choke collars, which are the chain link collars where you hear and you pull on the collar that's around the dog's neck. It's hurting me as I describe it, Dr. DePorter. Or e-collars, which are shock collars that provide exactly what I said, a shock literally to the dog. And then all these organizations that were on board with the general notion said, like the International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants, Victoria Stilwell Academy for Dog Training and Behavior, Karen Pryor Academy, Gene Donaldson Academy for Dog Trainers, all the good ones, Pet Professional Guild, and the Association for Dog Training International all said, no. And each organization then put out a statement about why using aversive equipment is not a good idea. So I want to start there. Go ahead.
Yeah, so the issue of anybody can say they're a dog trainer, and actually anybody can say they're a behaviorist. You know, even for myself, I fall under the American Veterinary Medical Association, and as a veterinarian, I'm a veterinary behaviorist. But, and that's the problem, is that the public is trying to find help for their dogs. And anyone who's got a flashy website and a fancy-sounding title can sound like they know what they're talking about dogs. And they get deceived and spend a lot of money and in many ways do a lot of harm for their dogs by following advice on by someone who's not qualified to be helping them.
Absolutely. So you think in theory this is a good idea, but I would suggest, knowing you as I do, that you also... I was going to say you also think, but I believe it's more appropriate to say you also know that certain dog training methods actually do cause harm and may, in fact, mean more business for you.
Well, there are so many, we call them kind of the traditional, you know, kind of the alpha, be the boss, be in charge, hurt dogs, prong, choke, shock collars. Those have been around for a long time. And part of the issue is people have gotten so accustomed to it and so, you know, well, my dog was raised like this when I was young and he was fine. And the problem is they're not fine. These methods work by causing anxiety. That's exactly what they do. And they get dogs to freeze or hold still or pause briefly. And then it seems like it seems harmless, but it's really not. And That is the big issue and the big controversy in the dog training world is the people that want to do things in a newer, kinder, gentler, more appropriate way is positive reinforcement are constantly in a battle with those that are trying to shock, be in charge, you know, cause pain. And they don't think they're causing pain. They're like, well, I put it on my wrist. It doesn't hurt. I pulled the prong. It doesn't hurt. If it makes the dog stop, then it hurts them.
Well put.
And then that's why the shock works. So if the dog's running along his yard and suddenly stops, he doesn't stop because he's suddenly having I should stay in my yard. My family owns this piece of real estate moment. He's stopping because he's remembering that he's been hurt there before.
So
and that's the danger.
Tell me about the study that you did.
So I worked with a veterinary clinic that wanted to do positive reinforcement starting with puppies. And they wanted to look at their own approach. So this was an internal hospital study that they did their own evaluation on. But they started basically with 400 puppies that they did positive reinforcement training with. And they tracked to see how long those puppies stayed in the home. Comparing that to what the standard is, 2/3 of dogs are in a new home before they're 2 years of age. And that statistic holds up. In this group of 400 puppies, over 90% of them were still in their home 2 years later.
All right, so let's repeat some of this. So you worked with a trainer that previously used aversive methods, punishment-based methods, and equipment like we've mentioned. Is that right?
Well, it was a veterinary hospital that worked with a trainer. And instead, what this veterinary hospital did is they took puppies that were coming into their clinic and said, we're no longer going to outsource you to this trainer. We're going to keep you in-house and do a positive reinforcement approach.
Right. And then the two were compared using, you know, a lot of studies out there, I will say, in veterinary medicine, particularly behavior studies, although this is changing, 24 dogs or 12 dogs or, you know, over the course of 3 days or something like that. This was, you followed these dogs for quite some time, and we're talking, you mentioned hundreds of dogs, correct?
Yeah, over 400.
Yeah, I mean, there haven't been a lot of studies. And what you found is that using positive training methods meant that those puppies lasted in the homes, and I don't remember the percent, you might, it's something like 98% of the time for over 2 years, and then a similar percent for over X number of years after that. Have I got that anywhere near correct?
Yeah, I know it's over 90% at the 2 year mark. I'd have to pull up the data to look at it closer. And we've gone back since and mined some more data from this that I haven't published yet. But what it brings home is that pets, you know, the two-thirds of dogs that are not in their home by 2 years of age, that's the problem with punishment-style methods. Methods that come along and yank dogs, scare them, correct them, intimidate them, they seem to work for a while. And then the dogs later on, they may growl or they may, you know, their anxiety flares up again. And then those dogs get kicked out of their homes. And that's how this is all intertwined.
And there's a lot there that you just said that I want to dive into. The dogs growl. And many trainers teach people, or people feel, okay, I'm going to then punish my dog for growling. That's not always a good thing. I want to talk about that when we come back. There have been an increase in the number of dog bites. I want to talk about that as well. And later, talk about some surveys that you're conducting, one about cats and one about fish. And we'll get to that all later on WGN with Dr. Teresa DePorter. So what do you think the most common dog names are, or cat names, today? I'm going to go through the top 10, the official list from Trusted House Sitters. So four dogs, number 10, Max. Used to be number one. Wow, what a drop. Bailey is number 9. Sadie, number 8. 7 is Cooper. I'm still looking for Snoopy, Lassie. I don't see them. Number 6 is Rosie. Number 5 is Daisy. Charlie is number 4. If you know Charlie well, I suppose you could say, hey, Chuck. Number 3, Lucy. Number 2, Bella. Number 1, Luna. Now for cats. 10 is Loki. I don't know anyone with a cat named Loki. I keep hearing that is a popular name, but I've never met a cat named Loki, at least not yet. Number 9, Milo. Number 8 is Lily. Number 7 is Max. Oliver is 6. Leo is number 5. Bella is number 4. Number 3 is Lucy. Among the dog names, number 3, Lucy. Same for dogs and cats. Number 2, Charlie. And number 1, same as for dogs, the most popular cat name is Luna. Now, this is kind of fun. The most popular movie-inspired pet names. Number 5 is, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 is Simba. Number 4 is Marley. Number 3, well, I should say, if you don't know, Simba from The Lion King, you probably do know. Number 4 is Marley from Marley and Me. Number 3, Rocky from Rocky. Number 2, Loki from the Marvel Universe. And number 1 is Nyla, or Nayla? How do you say that? From The Lion King. The book-inspired pet names. They broke this down really interestingly here. Number 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 is Tigger. That's from Winnie the Pooh, of course. Who remembers Winnie the Pooh, though? I guess people do. Number four is Harry from Harry Potter. Number three, again, Winnie from Winnie the Pooh. Number two is Jasper from Twilight. And number one is Bella from Twilight. Now, this is a fun one for me. The musician-inspired pet names. Number five, one, two, three, four, five, is Elvis, Elvis Presley. Number four, or is that number six? One, two, three, four, five. Yeah, number four is jazz. That's the whole genre. I don't know anyone who's pet. I've never met a pet named Jazz. Maybe Jazzy. Number, the next one is number one, two, three is Ringo, Ringo Starr. Number two is Freddie, Freddie Mercury. And number one, Bowie, as in David Bowie. Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN with Dr. Teresa DePorter, veterinary behaviorist. And you said earlier, as we are talking about dog training methods, Dr. DePorter, something in passing about the dog growls or snarls. And what happens is either the equipment you use, like, say, a e-collar or a shock collar, actually kind of trains the dog not to do that, not to growl. Or we, just because we innately think that, okay, if the dog is growling, we know what might come next, something that isn't very good. Let's then punish the dog for growling. Why is that not such a good idea?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what people think is this dog growls or it does something, quote, bad, and they go, no, quit, stop, leave it, don't. Some way of making that behavior stop. And a growl is really a way for the dog to say, I'm scared. I'm worried. Please get back. Please stop. I'm overwhelmed. And there are a lot of ways dogs say that, but the growl is the one that is somewhat universal. Everyone gets that one. They notice it. Now, the dog may have been, you know, yawning and licking its lips and averting its gaze and showing all kinds of signs that we now know are ways the dog shows its anxiety and fear. But the growl, if we punish the growl, if we tell the dog no for growling, they may stop growling. And then that means we're having people watch, you know, yawning, licking its lips. The dog skips the growl because that's been punished and reprimanded out of them, and then may go straight to a bite. And that's the danger.
Dog bite numbers do seem to be on the rise. Do you think that is one of the reasons, combined with those trainers and in social media and TikTok and Instagram that are saying or showing, you know, because you show things on those platforms, they're showing little video clips, maybe edited or not, of a dog that once attacked people, but then I took the shock collar and I did this, or I took a choke collar and I did this, or I trained the dog this way by showing I'm dominant. There's still trainers doing that. Actually, those trainers, I would suggest there's a resurgence of them over the past couple of years, that is one of, and there are many explanations, I would suggest, but that is one explanation as to why dog bite numbers are on the rise.
Yeah, in my part of the country, dominance methods have really never gone away. I've been practicing in the same area for over 25 years, and I still talk to people every day that they have to be the boss, they have to be in charge, they have to make dogs submit, and those things just aren't true. My philosophy for behavior has been, I believe we can help dogs' behavior problems and be nice and be kind and be gentle and be appropriate to what's good for the dog's welfare.
Now, you have probably 65, well, no, I think closer to 100 colleagues now, veterinary behaviorists, boarded veterinary behaviorist, probably twice that number or near that around the world. You can't represent every one of them, but I'm about to ask you anyway. Would you suggest that nearly all, if not literally, each and every one of your colleagues agrees with what you just said?
Yeah, I think in the U.S. we're about 120 veterinary behaviorists, and in Europe about 40 veterinary behaviorists, and then about 150 residents in the group. And I think that should be the one thing that we could all agree on. There is no reason to cause dogs pain or anxiety as a means of fixing their behavior.
So to be clear, I would suggest you are the ultimate experts. Those who are members of the College of Veterinary Behavior, absolutely, you are not only veterinarians but went to school for too many years after that and then have to take a boarded exam and write papers and do all those things you have to do to get to where you are today. And if anyone knows, veterinary behaviorists for sure know. And I don't understand the argument, except someone's pocketbook, so to speak, on the other side. You know, people make money off of this, but the dogs never benefit. The human-animal bond never benefits. Now, I want to talk about something else. You talked about dogs not – us inhibiting a growl is never a good idea. And you talked about the lick-lipping and the paw raising a little bit. Maybe you're the tail down. I'm not sure exactly what you rattled off. But they are signs that dogs express – of expressing yawning, expressing anxiety. Dogs are always, I would suggest, always communicating with us. Is it any different with cats? Are they communicating with us? And if so, do we understand what they're saying?
Yeah, I mean, animals communicate with their bodies, both dogs and cats. And we think we know what they're saying. Like, we make assumptions about what dogs are saying. We also make assumptions about what cats think. And in order to really understand their behavior, one of the essential elements is to get down to the basic body language and what their body language is saying. And cats, I love looking at cat body language.
Well, you just did a study about that. I'm not sure if your results are in or not. So what you did is you took a survey of cat parents from around America, maybe around the world, I don't know, and you asked questions. Are your results in yet?
No, they're not. We're still collecting data on this study.
Can people still?
We want to get some new participants.
Yeah. So how do people participate if you have a cat, if you've ever known a cat, how can people participate if they like?
So what we put together is a survey study. It's on a SurveyMonkey platform, and it's a series of pictures, and you get to look at the pictures and then answer your impression of the cat. And we're going to give a QR code for you guys to put on your site, or I can rattle off the SurveyMonkey link, which is SurveyMonkey GMFTDBQ. If you punch that into the SurveyMonkey system, you should be able to find the study. Or you can find me on my Facebook page, Teresa DePorter, DVMDACDB, Facebook page, and I will have the links there.
That's a lot. So the other way to do this is when we post this at WGNradio.com. That's an easy one to remember. I will have information about how to go there. Also, I'll post all of this on my website, stevedale.tv, as I do all the interviews I do on the radio. And similarly, there will be a link. So you want people who have ever had a cat to participate in this, Dr. DePorter?
For the cat one, anyone who wants to participate with their limited knowledge about cats or extensive knowledge about cats, this survey is going to help gather that information as well. So if you're willing to take a few minutes to do a cat survey, please do it.
You will help science. Now, the thing does not sound fishy to me, but what does is what we're about to talk about next, the human-animal bond that people have with their pet fish. I don't know that I've ever talked with you about this or ever on the radio at all about this. I've talked about fish before, but not in this way. But we will when we come back with Dr. Teresa DePorter on WGN. Veterinary behaviorist Dr. Teresa DePorter is here. When you studied for your board exams, I know that you study all kinds of species, way beyond dogs and cats, and their behavior in order to be who you are now, a veterinary behaviorist. Same for all your colleagues. Were fish a part of that?
You know, I distinctly remember questions on primates and snakes and birds and ferrets, hippos.
Hippos.
There might have been a fish question in there. I don't know. But it's a big part of our pet lives. Like, a lot of people have fish, and myself included now. And it's kind of a new passion for me to look to how we can improve the welfare of the fish in our home.
Now, I'm pretty ignorant about all this, so you have to help me. So aquariums can be freshwater or saltwater. Are some of the fish still wild caught? Because that would concern me just a bit.
Yeah, I mean, especially in the, like, I know more about the freshwater. Some are wild caught and some are captive raised, or captive bred. Things like the betta fish, you know, a lot of people go to the pet stores and see these betta fish in those little tiny bowls. Those are, you know, often captive bred. And then what's really sad is people feel like, oh, there's this little betta fish in this tiny bowl. I'm going to give him a better life. And they take him home. And that may be true, but they don't know how to take care of him. They don't know what he really needs. And
so what a betta fish really doesn't need, from what I understand, is another betta fish necessarily. So I know people who have bought like two or three of those betta fish and put them in one bowl. And that always doesn't work out so well. I don't think that's for the best welfare. On the other hand, my question in addition to that, is it fair to keep a betta fish in one little bowl all the time? I don't know.
Now, a single betta fish would like to live in at least a 5-gallon tank. They can maybe get by 2.5 gallons. There's actually a lot of science involved in fish keeping. It's water temperature, pH, there's a bacteria cycle, there's testing you have to do, plants involved. And that's part of the joy I find in it, is that it's a whole world. And as the fish caretaker, I'm responsible for every element of that fish's life, whether it's feeding, whether it's cleaning, whether it's pH and the water chemistry and the cycling of the bacteria in the tank, to help them live their absolute best life.
Well, I know there's studies that have been done famously in nursing care facilities and dentist offices as to how fish actually help to relax people. Have you found that to be true? And is there a human-animal bond between the people and the fish?
There are a lot of studies looking at just how relaxing it is to watch fish. Particularly, I like the fish, the freshwater fish that are kind of pooling as it moves together as a group. You know, it's really like friends and family fish tank, and it is very relaxing to watch them. And so that's part of what this new study is that I'm looking at. I want to gather information about how many people have fish, how many fish do they have, and a lot about how do they feel about their fish. Have they given them names? Do they, you know, have photos of them in their phone? And just to really get to the essence of that relationship.
And that study, is that available quite yet in mid-September where we are now?
Yes, it is. Now, what I've called this is the shoal study. And shoaling in fish is moving together as a group. And this is going to be available either on my Facebook page, or they can go to SurveyMonkey Shoal, SHOALSTUDY.
Oh, okay. So it's SurveyMonkey.com and then /Shoal?
Yep, Shoal Study.
Shoal Study. And or similarly, again, we'll put this at WGNRadio.com in the description that you're reading of this podcast, and or for sure, on my description, which goes at WGN Radio. No, it doesn't. SteveDale.tv. I ought to know my own website, SteveDale.tv. So we have got a couple of minutes left here. What is it about fish? Well, first of all, I suppose, Dr. DePorter, no one else is doing this. That might be a motivation. But in addition to that, why no one else is actually studying lots of things, right? Why fish?
In my last couple of years, I've added some fish to my home, and I really wanted to just gather more information and reach out and see, can we learn more about fish and the passion and relationships people have with these fish. And I hope a lot of people will take this study and share this study, and so that we can get some more information about these little creatures that share our homes.
Yeah, and there isn't a lot of information out there, so now I will get personal with you. Do you name your fish?
I'm sorry?
Do you name your fish?
Some of them I do name, yes.
What are some of the names?
Usually I name them after wine, so there's been Pinot Noir, Chardonnay.
Now, people have actually trained fish to do things. Do you think, I mean, so we know that, and you and I have talked about this both together at meetings, but privately as well, about the importance of enrichment for dogs and cats. The necessity might be a better word. All right, what about fish? Do we need to enrich their aquariums? And if so, how the heck do you do that?
Yeah, I think the environment that the fish live in is really important, and some of that includes the flow of the water. Some fish want to have a really fast flow, and others want it to be really slow. Some like to have a really dense overgrowth of plants to hang out in. Others want to be in a cave, and it's each species has very specific requirements. The cats, the Corydora catfish, I have a lot of those. They like to be underneath and behind rocks. They need wood in the tank to hang around with. Each fish species has their own requirements.
Are there individual differences? Do you find there are personalities from fish to fish?
Some of them, absolutely, particularly the betta fish. So I have a new female betta fish who she hasn't been named yet, but she's definitely got her own charm and her own sass, and she sits on my desk and hangs out with me every day. Very charming, very engaging.
What do you mean by charming and engaging? Do you think that she recognizes you, for example? I mean, when her tail wags, it's not because she's happy. It's because she has to swim.
She is looking straight at me and eye contact and swims up to the top and engages very. And that's what makes these betta fish so alluring, is that they are very interactive fish.
And they are beautiful as well. So take the fish survey. If you've ever kept fish, do you have to have fish currently to take the survey?
You need to have fish currently to actually take the whole survey, yes.
All right. And again, you can find it, a link to it anyway, at stevedale.tv or in the description of this podcast, or give me one more time the SurveyMonkey, the surveymonkey.com/shoalstudy. Is that it?
Shoal Study, S-H-O-A-L-S-T-U-D-Y.
All right. Always, always so good to catch up with you, Dr. DePorter.
Thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate the time today to talk about animals and their welfare and doing the best we can for them.
Nothing fishy about that. Thank you. Next week on the show, Jill Rappaport will be here. That name sound familiar? She was with the Today Show for many years. Today, she is the host of a podcast, which is about pets. She is a huge advocate for specifically adopting older dogs. Graymuzzle.org to learn more about it. She is on their advisory board, as am I. And she'll talk about a campaign that she's fronting to support dental health for older pets in shelters, because we know that so many of the older pets, which are most pets, dogs specifically, in shelters, have dental issues. And if we can clear those up, those dogs automatically become more adoptable. We'll also talk about the National Link Coalition and the relationship between violence to people and violence to animals with Phil Arkow. That's next week, where we'll talk to you bright and early on WGN.